And the mayor of this case is the people versus Hassan. And it, as I indicated, is a 44-minute case. Ms. Grundy, you're switching tables?
Yes.
You're appearing for the people in this matter?
Yes, ma'am.
And for the respondent, please, counsel?
Michael Mattis, registration number 37.
All right, Mr. Mattis. All right, we're ready to proceed on this case. And Ms. Grundy, you have 22 minutes. You'll have to keep track of your own time, please.
May it please the court. The judgment of the Court of Appeals reversing Mr. Hassan's conviction should be reversed because Mr. Hassan was not actually deprived of the rights the Sixth Amendment confers during the closure of two brief, cumulative, and foundational witnesses. Prior to officers Pascal and White's testimony in this case, the prosecutor moved to close the courtroom to protect their undercover identities and the integrity of their investigations. Defense objected, arguing that it would suggest that the witnesses were testifying about super secret stuff. The court granted the motion to close the courtroom and issued a limiting instruction informing the jury that the closure was to protect was based on the witnesses' jobs. Before either officer testified, this limiting instruction was issued. The first officer's testimony constituted 12 and a half pages of transcript, and the second officer's only 13 pages. In analyzing a preserved claim for violation of the right to a public trial, this court first looks, under the abuse of discretion standard, to whether a closure occurred. The people agree a closure occurred. Next, we look under the abuse of discretion standard to whether the court abused its discretion in applying the Waller factors. Now, the Waller factors include whether there was an overriding interest that was likely to be prejudiced, whether the closure was no broader than necessary to protect that overriding interest, whether the court considered alternatives to closures, regardless of whether they were offered by the parties, and whether the trial court made adequate findings to support the closure. Here, it's undisputed that the trial court did not conduct a Waller analysis, and therefore, the court would have abused its discretion under the Waller standard. Essentially, this is where the Court of Appeals analysis ended. It determined that based on the abuse of discretion, there was then a structural error and the defendant was entitled to relief. But this analysis is incomplete. The second step of a preserved public trial analysis should be, was the defendant actually deprived of the protections the Sixth Amendment is intended to confer? In this case, the answer is no. In looking at this question, we look to the nature of the Sixth Amendment right. And we also address whether the closure, no matter how brief or insignificant, actually deprived the defendant of the protections the Sixth Amendment right is intended to confer. The right to a public trial is unquestionably an important right of the accused, and courts should act to protect that right. And that's why Presley recognized that courts need to sua sponte consider alternatives to closure. Obviously, that didn't occur here, but that analysis does not tell us whether the defendant was actually deprived of the protections of the Sixth Amendment.
And can I interrupt you right there? Because I recognize that this framework you're encouraging us to adopt is derived from the Second Circuit line of precedent. And yet, I struggle a little bit with what you're asking us to do, because you're saying we have presumption, we first check to see whether a closure in fact occurred, and you can see that a closure occurred here. Then you walk through the Waller factors to determine whether that closure was proper or not, but then separately, even if it was improper or Waller was not followed, there's a third, or in your view, a second step to the analysis to determine whether Sixth Amendment violation actually occurred. And I struggle with that, at least under precedent. I didn't see that the Supreme Court blessed the Second Circuit's approach or suggested that in the event that the Waller analysis was not conducted, the court ought nevertheless to separately determine whether the Sixth Amendment violation occurred. So help me understand how your framework fits given what happened in Presley.
Certainly. In Presley, the closure was not trivial in any way. It was not a question of whether the defendant was deprived of his rights. It was simply that the court was not understanding that the right to a public trial attaches to voir dire. So in Presley, the court was presented with a different question. It wasn't a question of whether the Sixth Amendment right was actually deprived. It was. That was clear from the court's opinion. As it goes on to explain under the Waller analysis, how the right deprived the defendant of the protections of the Sixth Amendment. It's clear from the Supreme Court's holding that it was addressing the case as a Sixth Amendment violation. So implicit in the court's discussion, both in Waller and in Presley, is a finding that the right actually deprived the defendant of the Sixth Amendment protections. However, that's not the case in this situation, and it's not the case in those looked at by the Second Circuit, several of the jurisdictions that have addressed the triviality standard have done so after Presley, have done so after Waller, and found that the triviality standard is appropriate. It's also appropriate under this court's approach to approaching whether the defendant was actually deprived the right to counsel. In those cases, this court looks to whether the defendant was deprived of the right to counsel at a critical stage. If the counsel was not deprived at a critical stage, the right to counsel was satisfied. Similarly, if the right to counsel during the absence would have only had a minimal risk of impacting the rights, then the right to counsel was satisfied, and reversal is not required, even given the structural nature of that right. In this way, applying the triviality standard to public trial claims that have been preserved by objection is similar to how this court has approached other structural errors, and specifically the right to counsel. For if counsel is deprived at only a non-critical stage of trial, there is no violation, and therefore structural error is not the remedy that should be. And therefore structural error does not apply, because there's no actual deprivation of the structural right. The same is true in this context, where the closure during the testimony of two brief, cumulative, and foundational witnesses did not actually deprive the defendant of the Sixth Amendment protection.
You say that's implicit in Waller, yet it seemed to me that the vindication of the public trial right was a interest that the public holds, and you have to go through this balancing test. It wasn't gone in here. So I don't understand why we're slipping off the deck here when the prosecution set this whole thing up for these two witnesses that you now say weren't really critical, right? It's trivial. And all of a sudden we're not going to vindicate the public trial because of this. I don't get it.
Well, Your Honor, if we look to Waller itself, the closure was during a 7-day suppression hearing in which the public was excluded for all of it. Yet even in Waller, the Supreme Court did not find that closure was inherently inappropriate. It remanded back to the Georgia courts to determine whether that closure was justified under Waller's factors. But in Waller, the closure was clearly depriving the defendant in a way that could not be considered trivial. 7 days of closure during the testimony of wiretaps that only constituted 1.5 hours of total time could not be justified because it clearly deprived the defendant of the Sixth Amendment protections. The same cannot be said here. If we look to the cases that have actually applied the triviality standard, we see that the closures sometimes are trivial, sometimes are not. They apply the standard to determine whether the right was actually deprived. In the first circuit, closure during jury selection.
Well, let me just stay with what Justice Hobbs has asked you. Another way of framing it is, well, if it's so trivial and de minimis, why did the DA call these two witnesses? Right? They're not even among the five that we've talked about who were more directly involved in the five busts, and they're cumulative, et cetera. Then why did the DA deem fit to, and I realize you can't get into the DA's mind, but having the benefit of the transcript and looking at this carefully, what's your inferences to why the DA put us on this path in the first place?
Your Honor, I think it's sort of a reflection of the idea of, in a CSI world, juries like to hear from anyone who could have had any involvement in the case. It's the same reason why we frequently call fingerprinting analysts, even if no fingerprints are collected or if none of them can be matched. Or why would they call a DNA analyst, even if there was no DNA collected or if there was no DNA that could be matched? Because jurors sometimes like to hear from anyone who could have possibly been involved. That's exactly what it was for these witnesses. They were simply involved on some completely de minimis level, so the prosecutor called them to cover all bases. So there's no indication that these witnesses' testimony was critical, simply satisfying that anyone who had anything to do with this case was called. So there's not necessarily an answer for could the prosecutor have proven its case without them? Absolutely.
And what I hear, I don't mean to put words in Justice Hobbs' mouth, but the concern seems to be a little bit of, well, you reap what you sow. You decide that you want to, you know, fall prey to the CSI effect and put on 7 witnesses or however many for this bypass, then you have to live with the consequences of that. You don't get to turn around and call this trivial now. What's your response to that?
Well, Your Honor, if this court decides that's the case, that the court will not look at it under the triviality standard, then I urge this court to look back to the Waller standard and determine whether the remedy is actually appropriate to the violation and consider a remand as an alternative remedy. It's exactly what we saw issued in Waller. And under that circumstance, the trial court may very well make additional findings. Automatic reversal is not the appropriate remedy to be for this violation in this case.
I don't think this was an automatic reversal, was it? I thought the Court of Appeals went ahead and, on its own volition, applied the Waller standards, or the Waller test, and then determined there was a violation, as opposed to choosing to remand.
Yes, Your Honor. The problem with the Court of Appeals decision here is that they don't actually determine whether there was a Sixth Amendment violation before making the determination to reverse.
I understand, but what they essentially did was justify the Waller standard to the Waller test themselves as opposed to remand. They never even, as you correctly pointed out, never even reached that issue. And if I'm understanding your position, you don't really, I don't know, back and was just looking again at the summary of your argument, you don't really seem to have a concern about that, but rather you just want us to look at it as, even assuming that Waller should have, that was properly decided by the Court of Appeals, and their weighing of the standards was appropriate, this was nonetheless trivial. And that's the extent of your argument in front of us. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. The Court of Appeals should have reached the second step to determine whether there was actually a Sixth Amendment violation. In that sense, it's purely a question of the appellate procedure to be applied in preserved cases involving a Sixth Amendment public trial violation. The court should first determine whether the court abused its discretion, and second determine whether there was actually a Sixth Amendment violation. In this way, it should apply like the right to counsel, where there is a determination of whether the closure was actually in the nature of depriving the defendant of the structural right. This should occur before there is any type of remedy issued, whether that remedy be a remand or whether it be automatic reversal.
Can I ask you a question? I mean, what do you think the Waller factors purport to accomplish, if not to protect the Sixth Amendment right to a public trial? I mean, what is the purpose of walking through those factors? In other words, we start with the presumption that the trial is open, and you ought to have a really good reason to close it. And the Waller factors are a way to get at whether a really good reason in fact exists. And if in fact a really good reason does not exist, that presumption has been violated, right? So what other purpose do the Waller factors serve other than to protect that Sixth Amendment right?
Certainly they serve that function of protecting the Sixth Amendment right. But the important thing to note is that when those factors are not necessarily considered by the trial court, that does not inherently mean that the Sixth Amendment has been violated.
Okay.
If you look to this case, the trial court likely could have satisfied those factors, as protection of law enforcement who are undercover is often something that trial courts can close the courtroom for.
So in other words, let's rewind the clock and go back and have a Waller hearing to see whether closure would have been in fact proper at that time.
Your Honor, that remand, that would be something that the court could do on remand. And that is something that Waller actually looks at, is sending the case back to the trial court to conduct a Waller hearing before determining whether structural error is in fact occurred in the case. That's not what the Court of Appeals looked at here. They simply determined that the trial court's failure to conduct a Waller analysis
means automatic reversal.
Correct. And that should not be the standard applied by this court in reviewing these preserved claims.
Ms. Kramer, how do you see a limited remand working now? Do you think that would be a meaningful exercise at this point in time?
Your Honor, I think it would certainly be within the same context as this court's recent Brown decision for analyzing under the 11 factors for choice of counsel. I think it could certainly work to the same extent that the Brown remand works in analyzing some things that may or may not always be known years after the appeal has occurred. It is the onus is on the trial court, it's on the parties, to demonstrate what would have been true at the time that the closure occurred. Certainly, it is no more difficult than under the Brown remand, which this court determined was the appropriate remedy for the structural right of choice of counsel. It could certainly apply as well as that in this case. Now, there are some things that may or may not always be known, but knowing whether the officers would still be undercover is likely something that the prosecutor would be able to establish at that remand hearing. Knowing whether they're likely to, whether they continue their undercover operation, that type of thing could be determined at the time. There may be difficulties, but that certainly does not preclude a remand in every situation, and it does not preclude a remand in this case.
Oh, no, go ahead.
Please. Go ahead.
No.
I just want to ask a really quick question following up on Justice Marcus's question. Why wouldn't you make this triviality standard the first question of the analysis? I mean, logically, that's where your argument leads, isn't it? That shouldn't you ask first whether there's a violation? If there's a very minimal or de minimis closure, then there isn't.
Your Honor, I hadn't thought of that, but I think it could certainly work at that as a preliminary threshold question. If the closure is de minimis, then the rest of the steps need not be followed. I don't know that any other court has ever applied that factor, but there's certainly no reason why it couldn't. In that way, it would be consistent with the way that we analyze right to counsel claims, where we first determine was it a critical stage, and then would counsel's presence at that hearing in some way have more than a minimal risk. So certainly, triviality could be applied as a threshold question to determine whether the public trial right essentially attached and therefore could have been violated. There's no prohibition as to why that could occur, simply that most other courts in analyzing this have looked at it under a de novo review to see whether error occurred at all. I don't think there's a specific rationale as to why it would need to occur first or why it would need to occur second. Under either approach, the result would be the same. If the closure is too trivial to actually implicate the Sixth Amendment rights, then the closure does not deprive the defendant of the right to a public trial, and therefore some remedy other than reversal is required. It may simply be that there is no remedy, or maybe that a remand is the appropriate step that the court should take.
Thank you.
Since we're back to triviality, I'm very unclear about what you think the standard, assuming we go with you, that there is this question of closure has to be non-trivial in order to actually violate the right. What is the standard you're aiming at for deciding whether something is trivial?
Your Honor, I think the Second Circuit in Peterson probably is the best explanation for what the triviality standard would be. And it's essentially looking to whether the actions that the court took and the effect they had on trial. So we look to see whether temporary closure actually violated the right. Some of the things that we look to in this are whether the information that was testified to was repeated later in trial, which it was here, or sometimes whether it's summarized in closing arguments. We would also look to the brevity of the closure.
Why would that be? Why would that be with regard to your right to a public trial? I mean, here, as Justice Hobbs said earlier, there's some question, I guess, where you're not actually involved in the trial. One might raise questions about voir dire or a suppression hearing that's outside, and the Supreme Court's dealt with it. Here you've got, it sounds like, basically, eye and ear witnesses in the trial itself. Apropos of Justice Hood's question, the prosecutors decided these are important enough to put on, and the public has been deprived of hearing these witnesses. What makes them trivial? Are you aiming at something like a harmless error standard, a cumulative testimony standard? What?
No, Your Honor, triviality would be very different from harmless error, because harmless error applies only once an error has been found. Triviality is different from the harmless error standard in that it applies to a question of whether there was, in fact, error at all.
Right, so how do we decide that?
One way to look at it that the Second Circuit has looked at is the purposes that the public trial is intended to confer are to ensure witnesses to come forward. If witnesses have heard that same information, that right has been satisfied. It's to discourage perjury. If that same information has come out from so many witnesses, the purposes of discouraging perjury is satisfied. Similarly, to encourage the court and the prosecutor to beware of their task. During this brief and de minimis closure, the prosecutor and the court are certainly aware of their tasks. We also see that the fourth component is that the public sees that the defendant is fairly treated. When the public is present for the vast majority of the trial and only excluded for this 26 pages of transcript, that right has been satisfied, and the public trial guarantee is ultimately present. Accordingly, the triviality standards looks to the duration of the closure, it looks to the substance of the information disclosed during the closure, and it looks to whether that information was repeated elsewhere in testimony. At this point, I'd like to reserve my remaining 2 minutes for rebuttal.
You may do so, of course. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Michael Mattis, registration number 37869, here on Mr. Hassan's behalf, the respondent in this case. Now, I'm going to begin by addressing the question presented first. However, this court would like me to address other issues that were raised by the Attorney General in the briefs. I'm prepared to do so as well. Now, the question we are here to discuss today is whether the Court of Appeals erred when it concluded that the exclusion of Mr. Hassan's family and the public from his criminal trial constituted structural error. Now, the Sixth Amendment of the United States Constitution provides that the accused shall enjoy the right to a public trial, and the Colorado Constitution does so as well. The right to a public trial has many purposes. It ensures that courts are not used as instruments of persecution. It protects our citizens from abuses of police, prosecutorial, and judicial power. It discourages perjury. It guarantees citizens receive a fair and just innocence or guilt determination, and it maintains public confidence in the criminal justice system by allowing the public to see that justice is being served. Now, in this case, the trial court closed the courtroom to Mr. Hassan's family and the general public during the entire testimony of two of the prosecution's police witnesses. And neither the prosecutor nor the court addressed any of the Waller factors. And so the Court of Appeals held, as it was required to do, that the closure violated Mr. Hassan's constitutional rights to a public trial, and that violation constitutes structural error, which is automatic reversal.
Actually, the question includes in it a small portion of the trial, not excluded from the trial, right? Because it was a small portion here?
That's what the cert question says, yes. But I disagree that it's a small portion or insignificant.
And maybe you could address that, because it seems to me that may be the heart of the argument, right, and with counsel. What does constitute exclusion from how much of the trial and what kind of witnesses, what part of the trial would constitute a violation of the right to a public trial?
Well, the duration of the closure or the extent of the closure, there's a lot of factors that the courts have looked to that have adopted this triviality analysis. Okay, so for example, one of the questions is whether the closure was complete, everyone is excluded from the courtroom, or whether it's partial. Some people are excluded, but other members of the public are allowed in. So I think, and there are several other factors that I will get to when we get to the analysis part, but I think the question of duration is only one of many, many factors to consider when you're considering whether the closure was trivial or not. Does that make sense?
Sure. And so what are the factors that we'll consider then in deciding whether it was trivial?
Well, we're talking about Peterson here. And my first point before I get into that, I'd just like to say that Peterson is non-binding case law from the Second Circuit. The Court of Appeals was in no way, shape, or form required to follow this case and perform this triviality analysis as the Attorney General argues. Okay? And that the Court of Peterson listed the protections conferred by the Sixth Amendment as to ensure a fair trial, to remind the prosecutor and judge of their responsibility to the accused and the importance of their functions, to encourage witnesses to come forward, and to discourage perjury. Now, when you're considering those four factors, Courts look to whether the closure was intentional or inadvertent. Intentional closures implicate the Sixth Amendment more than inadvertent ones, because in an intentional closure, the parties themselves, the police, the judges, the prosecutor, they know that there is in fact a closure. In an inadvertent closure, it implicates the Sixth Amendment less, because the court would not, the witness might not know that there was a closure.
But there's no suggestion here that this is inadvertent. Is that not right?
No, that's absolutely true, Your Honor.
Okay.
I'm just pointing out the fact that this was a complete closure, and there are very, very few cases that have considered a complete closure trigger.
Okay.
And the courts also look to whether the closure disenfranchised the general public or whether it disenfranchised the defendant's family. And the rationale there is that the public trial right is supposed to protect against abuses of power by people in power, and the defendant's family is more likely to stand up and assert and fight for their family members' rights and alert the court to some sort of problem, as opposed to the general public who has no interest in the case and they're not really going to hold the prosecutor, police, or judges to their task. The last thing the courts look at is when a closure occurred. Was it during voir dire or was it during testimony? And the cases indicate that if it's during testimony, that implicates the Sixth Amendment right more than during voir dire. And of course, that's because during testimony, we're talking about discouraging perjury and encouraging witnesses to come forward, and those concerns are not present during voir dire. Now that this court, I'm arguing that this court should not adopt this Peterson analysis at all, because it's not applicable. It hasn't been recognized by the United States Supreme Court.
Would you say then that any closure, any deprivation of public participation or viewing at all, no matter how small, during the course of the trial would be a Sixth Amendment violation?
I would. If it's an intentional closure and the court goes through the Waller factors and it's unjustified, then I think that it is structural error. As Justice Marquez was saying earlier, the Waller test is the test that the Supreme Court designed to remedy these problems of small closures or big closures, or because in the analysis the court is considered, well, what's the scope of the closure? If it's only 5 minutes, then yeah, I think it's justified and I'll close the courtroom, and on appeal that's protected. There's not going to be a windfall there if the court goes through the Waller analysis and determines that the closure is justified or not.
Maybe you're going to get there later, but what about the notion of limited remand? How viable do you see that being at this juncture?
Well, first of all, I think the Court of Appeals opinion was correct in that the cases indicate that a limited remand is proper in a partial closure type of situation, because it's less of a, it implicates the Sixth Amendment less. And that there are no cases that indicate that under complete closure that a remand is required. And I would also like to go back and say that in Waller, the court didn't remand for findings to determine whether there was a closure error. The court remanded for a new suppression hearing and then said if the court would still like to close parts of that suppression hearing, it then has to go through the Waller factors. So I say that because the remand is not—it's not supported by law, given Waller and especially given Presley. I mean, the Supreme Court could have sent the case back to the Georgia court for a remand for the court to determine whether there were any alternatives to closure and essentially to fix its deficient ruling, but it didn't.
So the counterpart here is a new trial. There isn't any other result that indicates the right.
Absolutely. And that brings me to another point. The Attorney General relies on Waller's statement that the remedy should be appropriate to the violation. And the Attorney General argues that that means that the court is suggesting to appellate courts that they can make up their own remedies to public trial right violations. But when you read that statement in context, what the court was saying was that because there was an error in the suppression hearing, a public trial error in the suppression hearing, that the remedy should be appropriate to the violation and a new suppression hearing should be ordered. But if there's a public trial error that occurs at trial, the remedy is a new trial. The court was in no way suggesting that the appellate courts should feel free to create their own quasi-structural error type of new standard of review to deal with public trial errors.
And I suppose that's consistent with the outcome in Presley then, in that the remand is, it's a reversal of presumably remand for new trial.
Absolutely.
Not simply new voir dire.
Yes, right. Now, I also wanted to note that the Presley decision was a summary disposition, which I think is an important point because it indicates to me that the Supreme Court felt that the law was so established and so clear that it didn't even need briefing from the parties or oral argument. It didn't think that the law needed to be changed, and it felt that it could just decide the decision on the cert briefs alone. And I think the language in Presley supports that reading of the case. It's a very strong opinion that is basically telling the Georgia court, you have to go through this factor before closing the courtroom. If you don't, it's going to result in a new trial.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, sir.
Based on when you were running through the various factors one would look at,
mm-hmm.
One of the things you placed heavy emphasis on whether the closure was inadvertent or it was intentional.
Mm-hmm.
And then in response to my question, you indicated that Waller basically takes up the entire area with regard to closing a courtroom for intentional. Intentionally closing courtrooms. What about inadvertent closures?
Well, the courts have treated inadvertent closures differently across the board. Some, I think that when you read Peterson, it was, it's pretty clear that Peterson was intended to be applied to only inadvertent closures. And I believe that because.
And I guess the question I'm looking at, as you point out, we're not bound by Peterson one way or the other.
Right.
In terms of trying to conceptualize why we would do one or the other, or what the U.S. Supreme Court may have intended, what is there that makes the closure any less significant for purposes of the public participation if it was inadvertent?
Yes. The case law is not clear on that point. For example, the Tenth Circuit has a rule that unless it is an affirmative act by the judge, it cannot be a violation of the public trial right. And I tried to trace that back to its origin by going through the prior cases that were cited. And it's one of those situations where at some point in history, a court said that it has to be an intentional act by a judge, and then everyone followed it, and there is no reason. Because I agree with you, it shouldn't matter. A closure is a closure, whether it's intentional, whether it's done by the judge intentionally, or it's done by the bailiff or the courtroom because of some misunderstanding. But I would point out here that this, of course, was not inadvertent. And if the case is presented to you where it isn't inadvertent, there are many cases that address that. Although it's not consistently, some cases use the triviality analysis to dispense with an inadvertent closure. That is minimal. It would have to be minimal as well. And some courts say that it's not even a violation of the Sixth Amendment because it's inadvertent, it was a mistake, basically.
May I ask you to shift gears and talk to us about the application of the Waller factors? If we get there and we're asked to give courts, or we're trying to give courts guidance on the particularity that's necessary, how would you suggest we do that? Because had this court conducted the Waller analysis, how do you think it should have done that, evaluating specifically the threat to the undercover officers?
Yeah, well, the cases indicate that in those situations, because there are many cases that where the court closes the courtroom door to protect the undercover officers, and a lot of them, for some reason, are from New York State. And so when you look at the cases in New York State, they really require a particularized showing. For example, they require the proponent of the closure, and in this case it would be the prosecutor, to show that the undercover officer was actually working undercover in the area in which the public that is going to be attending this trial might recognize them.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No,
I'm just wondering whether that should be dispositive. That to me seems to oversimplify things a little bit for undercover operations. Well, and how do you define the area? So help me with that.
Well, the way the courts have defined the area is just basically, the undercover officer says, for example, I've been working in Adams County, and then if the hearing or trial is in Adams County, then they've proven that they are working at the time. And some courts even drill it down to the exact neighborhood. If the courthouse is in a certain neighborhood and the undercover cop is working that neighborhood at the time of the trial, then that's sufficient. And if he or she is not, then it's not sufficient.
And I guess that's my quandary is, okay, are we talking about Adams County or are we talking about the neighborhood? What do you think?
I think it has to be very, very particularized. I mean, the Waller test is hard. It's hard to satisfy, and I think the court meant for it to be hard to satisfy because the right to a public trial is one of the most fundamental rights that we as citizens have, and without it, we cannot have a fair trial.
Thank you. Mr. Mattis, can I follow up on that? Good morning.
Yes.
The third factor is the court must consider reasonable alternatives in closure. And when we're trying to, in this case, let's assume that there is the first prong that it advances an overriding interest, the police safety, the undercover identity. What would be reasonable alternatives that would still, make it a public trial but protect the identity?
Well, courts have said that placing a screen in front of the witness would be a reasonable alternative to closure. And I think that a reasonable alternative to complete closure would be to require the government or the proponent of the closure to identify someone that they believe might be a problem for this undercover. Like, for example, in one of the cases, one of the people sitting in the audience, it was shown that he had a criminal record. And the court excluded him from the courtroom because he would have, he was going to be communicating with the criminal element and might out this undercover officer. So,
it just based on your facial expression, I can tell you think that's a bit of a sticky wicket, right? I
mean,
if we're going to start asking people who they are in the courtroom, doesn't that chill the effect of the public courtroom? I'm sympathetic to the trial court just trying to figure out, I look out here, I don't know who a lot of the people are. How would a trial judge be able to discern all that?
Absolutely. But you have to remember, too, in this case, we had an objection, and the prosecution was the proponent. And so it's not really on the trial judge to come up with these reasons, it's the prosecutor's burden to show that there's an overriding interest in the closure.
So maybe that goes back to the first prong again of interest likely to be prejudiced.
Right.
They've got the burden to show.
Right. In the situation I was talking about, I agree. It's shady, but in that case, it must have been that the prosecutor was saying, I know this person, they have a criminal record, and that's how the court knew. But again, the Waller factors are designed to be hard to achieve because we want open courtrooms and they're a necessary part of a fair trial.
All right, thank you, Mr. Mattis.
Okay, well, the last point I would like to make is that of all the cases cited by the state, and there's 38 or so of them, some are habeas cases that have the highly deferential standard of review. Of all of them, not one court deemed a closure like the one here that was during witness testimony of two police witnesses trivial when it was an intentional closure, it was a complete closure, it excluded family and the general public from the testimony of two prosecution witnesses. There is not one example with those factors present where the courts found that this was trivial. Clearly, the closure here implicated Mr. Hassan's rights to a public trial, and the Court of Appeals decision must therefore be affirmed. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Mattis, thank you very much. Ms. Grundy, you have a couple of minutes?
May it please the court. I'd like to briefly address this court's questions regarding what type of guidance to give to trial courts in analyzing what sort of factors they should look at in closing the courtroom specifically during undercover officers. Now, some of the New York cases have referenced closures based on the undercover's participation being so small as to be within the neighborhood. But I think it's important to recognize that standard based on the size of the New York City or the size of Colorado are not necessarily appropriate. Now, if we look to whether the officer is undercover, certainly it could be anywhere within the Denver metro area that witnesses would be likely to be present. It could be anywhere on the front range. It could go far further than that. The New York cases don't provide perfect guidance because there's 8 million people in Manhattan, and we don't have that many people basically in our time zone. So it's important to recognize that Waller is really a flexible analysis in which the trial court may craft procedures that are appropriate based on the circumstances presented to it in a given case. The trial court could have done that here, and we agree that it did not conduct that analysis. But that ultimately doesn't answer the question of whether the defendant was deprived of the Sixth Amendment right to a public trial. I'd like to direct this court to the Second Circuit's decision in Smith versus Holland. There, the trial court closed the courtroom during the testimony of an undercover officer, who was the only officer to identify the defendant, and the closure lasted for 112 pages of 314 of transcripts. Yet, even in that situation, the Second Circuit determined that the appropriate remedy was to remand to determine whether the closure was appropriate under those circumstances. Some courts, even in applying trivial, determined that this closure was not trivial, but analyze it to help us determine whether an inadvertent closure may actually deprive the defendant of the Sixth Amendment right. They help us look at whether a brief closure and whether one that was not by the court actually deprived the defendant of those rights. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I want to thank you, Ms. Grundy, for your argument this morning. Mr. Mattis, thank you, sir. We appreciate your argument. The court will be in recess for 15 minutes.